May it please the court, your honors, David Mahan, registration number 15146 with Wells Anderson Race for Rivergate Law Partners. Refer to them as RLP for short. The contested jury instruction on indemnity violates Colorado law. It wrongly assumed the mere existence of a claim triggered a right to indemnity reimbursement of a settlement when only some of the settled claims could trigger indemnity. The burden to prove a right to indemnity reimbursement goes beyond the mere existence of a claim that might trigger indemnity. Instead, the jury must be asked to determine whether the act triggering indemnity has occurred, if that act was in dispute, as it was here. When the party's agreement limits indemnity only to Genic's role as ROP's manager, that's the role they had to prove liability for. Genic's construction had more than one role at Rivergate. Genic's Construction was the original general contractor, and Genic's Construction was sued and had liability exposure for its own construction work. Genic's Construction was exposed to over $10 million in construction defect claims, and it's undisputed that Genic's Construction had no right to indemnity reimbursement for Genic's Construction's construction roles. That's why, in fact, Genic's Construction had 10 policies of insurance with Bituminous, which covered construction defect claims. So when Bituminous settled Genic's Construction from the condo owner's lawsuit, 2 years into that lawsuit, for $6.9 million, an amount well below the claims for Genic's Construction for the dirt work alone, there had been no factual finding of liability for any claim, and RLP never conceded that Genic's had liability as its manager. Bituminous settlement with the condo owners denied any liability on the part of its insured, Genic's. So even in Bituminous itself and its insurer, Genic's Construction, had disputed whether Genic's was liable as RLP's manager. The condo owner's damages could have been caused by any number of claims arising from Genic's Construction's role and work at Rivergate, but indemnity flowed for only a limited set of claims, none of which were ever proven at the time of the settlement or even through trial. Despite the fact that liability was contested, Bituminous was permitted to give jury instruction based only on the existence of a claim or potential liability. And it was and remains RLP's position that the entire $6.9 million settlement was for non-indemnifiable construction defect claims arising from Genic's role as a contractor. The instruction Bituminous tendered, I have additional paper copies for the court if you want to refer to them during the argument. The instruction Bituminous tendered, in which was given over RLP's objection, erroneous allowed Bituminous to avoid its burden of proof, contrary to the limits imposed by the party's agreement. The key portion of the instruction given to the jury in paragraph 3 only asked the jury to find whether a claim existed against Genic's as RLP's manager. Solely on the existence of a claim, the jury was then given a go-ahead to allocate whatever money they saw fit to the limited and unproven claims for which indemnity might be owed. The instruction in paragraph 4 talks of claims or potential liabilities. Aside from the sufficiency of evidence issue, remember not even Bituminous's lawyer could put a dollar value on the claim in closing, the instruction misstates the law by allowing the mere existence of a claim to trigger an indemnity payment for reimbursement of settlement. Lafarge versus KECI stands for the proposition that when an act triggering indemnity is in dispute and the claimant's injuries or damages could have been caused by any number of other claims for which no right to indemnity exists, the mere existence of an unproven claim cannot trigger the right of indemnity reimbursement, even though a settlement is paid to resolve all the claims. It's worth noting that Lafarge addressed a right to reimbursement of defense costs that is not before this court. So while a claim alone might trigger a right to defense costs reimbursement under the right conditions and issues, the claim alone cannot support a right to indemnity reimbursement of settlement when the claim is disputed and when other claims for which no right of indemnity exists could have caused an injured party's loss. In Rivergate, the trial court postponed any claims for defense costs and attorney's fees. So the matter of a defense apart from indemnity wasn't tried below and is not the subject of this appeal. What's at issue here is a right to an indemnity payment in reimbursement for a settlement when many claims were made, but none proven, and only some claims could be a basis for indemnity. Bituminous admits a de novo standard of review applies to whether the jury instruction correctly states Colorado law. RFP submits the erroneous jury instruction requires a retrial with a corrected jury instruction. But other standalone reasons support a new trial. It's an abuse of discretion to permit a plaintiff to take a multi-million-dollar claim to trial with discovery frozen and not require the plaintiff to make the most basic Rule 26 witness and document disclosures. Requiring plaintiff to disclose witnesses and documents probably would have changed the outcome of the trial. Because based on what's been revealed at trial and since, it should be apparent that there are more witnesses and documents that have facts relevant to the allocation of settlement funds that RLP never had access to, and the record here supports a retrial, this time with full disclosure.
Mr. Mahan, what sanctions were requested prior to trial when it first became apparent that these discovery violations had occurred?
The sanction that was requested and that was initially granted before the opening statements was the striking of Mr. Fitzpatrick as a witness.
Okay, but you're not separately appealing the trial court changing its mind and letting Mr. Fitzpatrick testify as non-expert.
Well, that's part of the abuse of discretion that goes into it, because when the trial court reversed itself 9 days or so later, as trial was already going on and by the time Bituminous was putting on its case, then it arose, it created issues with respect to what other documents are out there, not from just from Mr. Fitzpatrick's file, but from others. The requests were made in the record, and those requests for files like Mr. Weekly's complete file were denied. So that's the entire aspect of the trial court's freezing of discovery, allowing Mr. Fitzpatrick to testify, despite our objections, halfway through or more than halfway through the trial, and not allowing document disclosure of any other witnesses or parties was all part of the abuse of discretion.
And other than making of objections to the court's reversal of its earlier ruling, were any other sanctions requested when the court allowed the testimony of Mr. Fitzgerald?
When the court allowed the testimony of Fitzpatrick, it was it was done over our objection, but there were additional sanctions requested that were denied. Supplemental document. The only thing that the court decided to allow when it froze discovery was the production of settlement agreements from the condo owner settlement back in September and October of 2011. We realized during trial that not all of those documents were produced, and we moved for sanctions for that, which were denied. And I think there was a sanction issue with respect to another production, and the court said no harm, no foul. So what the argument was from Bituminous is you're getting it eventually, there's no harm, no foul.
Counselor, did you seek a continuance or a new trial or anything along those lines?
We sought a new trial at the end of the closure of the case. We sought, we didn't seek a continuance for a number of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, it's impossible to stop the commencement of something when it's almost finished. The continuance wouldn't have affected would have affected the fact that two cases were tried in one. It really would have required a bifurcation. RLP was pursuing a claim for breach of contract against Genix. Bituminous' claim for indemnity back against RLP involved similar witnesses, similar documents, the same attorneys. So a continuance of the case by Bituminous against RLP would have damaged and directly affected RLP's defense of the contract or prosecution of the contract claim. It would have made it too difficult for us to go back and do two trials rather than one, and we certainly weren't going to continue our breach of contract case. One of the most important documents in the case, Exhibit 2196, was revealed during trial and proved the terminus admitted to internally allocating $6 million of the settlement to completed operations products coverage. In other words, classifying the settlement in a manner directly inconsistent with what it was claiming in trial. Bituminous internally admitted that $6 million was allocated to construction defects, when at trial they were claiming the whole 6.9 was due to Genix's liability as RLP's manager. Yes, that document was produced during trial, and yes, it was admitted. But what's most important about that was what was left out of 2196. How was the other $900,000 allocated? The exhibit doesn't say. Bituminous' lone witness, Mr. Fitzpatrick, didn't know. The author of Exhibit 2196 was never disclosed before trial. No other documents were produced from him, Mr. Weekly, the author of 2196, despite RLP's request during trial, which were denied on May 10th at page 18 of the record. There's only one entity in this room who knows how that other money was allocated, and they've never been forced to disclose their internal admissions. The trial court initially granted RLP's relief, striking Fitzpatrick from testifying, and then reversed itself later. The court then denied RLP's repeated request for basic Rule 26 disclosures. Rule 26 exists separate from the discovery rules. It's self-executing. It helps form the very foundation of a fair trial. And without full disclosures, trial resorts to gamesmanship and ambush.
Well, it was clear before trial that Bituminous had made no Rule 26 disclosures, correct?
By the time they designated their trial witness 40 days before trial, their disclosure wasn't due yet. Then their disclosure was due some 10 days after. So within 30 days of trial, it was apparent that their disclosures were due.
Okay. Yes, did you seek any of the kind of sanctions that are discussed in cases like Trattler, such as precluding Bituminous from offering evidence, requiring the court, asking the court to instruct the jury on Bituminous's lack of cooperation, asking the court to instruct the jury that certain issues had been deemed admitted?
The effect of the first grant of the order striking Fitzpatrick was what we sought and what was granted, that we believe was the proper sanction for the effect of that. So once that order was granted, striking Fitzpatrick, Bituminous claimed vociferously, "Judge," they said, and it's in the record, "we can't try this case. He's our lone witness. Don't do this to us." But the judge struck him anyway, and not reversing itself until 8 or 9 days into trial. So the sanction that we requested was the relief that we thought was proper.
Okay, and when the judge reversed himself, you didn't ask for continuance or you didn't ask for any other sanctions, correct?
Well, we asked for, it was granted over our objection, but a continuance we felt would have been impractical because the discovery was already frozen. The judge had already made up his mind to try this case in 4 months without allowing any discovery, and we felt it was impossible to postpone the start of something that was almost finished. So we never felt like the continuance was a proper remedy. And in addition to the court statements, at the trial itself, the party given inadequate or incomplete information should not be responsible for conducting discovery to remedy the violation. That's not from our brief. That's from the original court's order sanctioning Bituminous for not disclosing witnesses and documents by first striking Mr. Fitzpatrick. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Dan Mortel, attorney registration number 34902. I'm here on behalf of my client, the Bituminous Casualty Corporation. I'll begin by addressing the disclosure issue, and then I'll address the jury instruction raised by RLP on appeal. First, I want to talk about whether or not RLP properly preserved its Rule 26 disclosure violation argument for purposes of appeal. And Bituminous's contention is that RLP did not. During trial, RLP raised two specific issues. One was the late disclosure, according to RLP, of Mike Fitzpatrick as a witness. And the second related to the disclosure during trial of a settlement document that fell within the ambit of the court's limited discovery and disclosure order once the settlement with the original HOA plaintiff had occurred. Those are the two issues that were raised.
And 2196 did not surface until trial.
Well, it did. Well, let me address that. Number one, just so the court's aware, both parties, both RLP and Bituminous, were ordered to do document production during trial. It was not only Bituminous that was ordered. And in fact, the way that this document surfaced was that Bituminous subpoenaed the file of RLP's own lawyer, Dennis Polk, who produced those documents at trial, And in those documents that were produced, there was another draft or iteration of a settlement document that had Mr. Polk's handwritten notes on it. And once that document was produced and clearly was in the actual or constructive possession of RLP through its counsel, RLP had an opportunity to review it and use it during trial. So those were the two issues that were raised by RLP. It wasn't until the post-trial Rule 59 motion that RLP made the later broader argument that there was a wholesale failure to produce documents or make Rule 26 disclosures. On that point, it's important for the court to know that Bituminous substituted in as the real party in interest. And in doing so, it stepped into the shoes of Jacks, its insured. So it's disingenuous in my view to say that there were no Rule 26 disclosures. As a substituted party, Bituminous has the opportunity and the right to avail itself of all of the disclosures that its predecessor made. And there were numerous disclosures, tens of thousands of documents traded hands. There were Rule 26 disclosures, there were supplemental disclosures. What RLP complains of is that 3 months before trial, when Bituminous stepped into the shoes of GenX as the named real party in interest, that it then didn't do a separate freestanding Rule 26 disclosure in the formal sense. But what the trial court looked at was everything that Bituminous is offering at trial are things that are in the that are within the knowledge of RLP already, and specifically the settlement agreements. And what the trial court did was say, we're not getting into post-settlement allocation. The relevant information for purposes of this trial is what was the state of mind of the parties, what was the posture of the case at the time of settlement. And that's why the court limited any disclosure or discovery for post-settlement matters. That wasn't something that was done by Bituminous. That was the trial court's order, given what the facts were at issue during trial and what the relevant facts were. So, given that, Judge Webb, you asked whether or not there were any other sanctions or whether or not any other sanctions were requested by RLP. It's important to note that, A, Bituminous never offered a single document or a single piece of information into evidence that was not disclosed and in the possession of RLP. So we're not talking about getting sandbagged with a document that they've never seen or a witness talking about areas that RLP could not have anticipated this witness would have knowledge of. And the court specifically limited Mr. Fitzpatrick's testimony to those areas that related to the settlement.
Were there any smoking gun kind of documents that you wouldn't want to produce as part of your evidence?
But
they would want to produce?
Absolutely not. You know, the one document that Mr. Mahan spoke about was a settlement agreement that tracked all of the other settlement agreements that had already been produced. And there was one allocation document, and I want to get to that issue about allocation. RLP's appeal, to me, it seems, hinges on the court buying into the idea that the post-allocation, you know, post-settlement issues are relevant. And the trial court addressed that head-on through this discovery. What mattered in this case was, at the time of settlement, what was the exposure that Bituminous or GenX was facing? Was the settlement reasonable in light of that exposure? And then we asked the jury to determine of all of the claims that were brought against Bituminous or GenX by the association, the plaintiff, what claims arose out of GenX's role as manager of RLP, because that was the only piece of the overall lawsuit that was covered by the indemnity claim that we're talking about. Anything else that dealt with dirt work or that dealt with the period of time that GenX was the construction manager, those fall outside the ambit of this indemnity agreement. So that was the factual issue at trial. How Bituminous later, and in retrospect, allocated its payments through the insurance policies for purposes of exhausting them and notifying their insurer that policy A, policy B, and policy C are now exhausted and you have no coverage, the court determined that's not relevant. And that's why the court didn't issue more sanctions based on this discovery or disclosure issue that has only been raised in post-trial motions and on appeal. I want to talk about the jury instruction.
Mr. Wartell, let me ask you one quick more question about the discovery before you make your next point. To the extent that we rely on the failure mid-trial after the first sanction was basically backed away from,
yeah.
Such as a failure to ask for a continuance at that point. I guess I'm thinking back to decades ago when I practiced in Texas, attorneys were expected to say no by exception after their objection was denied, and that was later abandoned as excessive formality. And I'm wondering if the requirement that people ask for continuance has almost reached that level of excessive formality, particularly in a case such as this where the substantial portion of the trial has already occurred.
Yeah, I think that asking for a continuance, I do agree with Mr. Mahan that a continuance mid-trial probably would not have been a feasible option, but I think that argument and that point is predicated on the assumption that there was a discovery violation that warranted a sanction beyond what the court did. And here, Bitumis fundamentally disagrees with the notion that there was any discovery violation. Number one, we stood in the shoes of Genex, and we did make Rule 26 disclosures. Number two, the court had already ruled that post-settlement documents were not relevant to the trial, and that therefore that would not have prompted Bitumis to say to itself, hey, we better do a supplemental disclosure. Number three, there was never any issue raised about the failure of a Rule 26 disclosure until literally the eve of trial. 12 hours before jury selection is when RLP filed a motion to strike Mr. Fitzpatrick, and that was the first time that RLP had raised with the court the existence of any discovery dispute. And relying on the Antolovich case, the trial court later in its ruling said, look, you can't wait until an unfavorable verdict to raise issues about discovery violations. Now, they did raise the specific issue regarding Mr. Fitzpatrick, and they did raise the specific issue about this one document that was in RLP's counsel's own possession. Beyond that, that was it, and that was the trial court's reasoning. With regard to the jury instruction, Bitumis relied, and the trial court relied, on the Burlington Northern case to craft the instructions in this case. And I believe that Bitumis and the trial court got it right. Burlington Northern deals with situations where there's an indemnity agreement, but only some of the overall claims or damages are covered by the indemnity agreement, which is the situation here. Genex was covered by indemnity or for indemnity for actions arising out of its role as manager. It was not covered under this agreement for the dirt work or for the construction management activities. So we have a situation analogous to Burlington Northern, where you've got some claims that are covered, some are not. And we followed the jury instruction, and the jury was not, there's been a lot of argument about how Bitumis shirked its burden. I think that Bitumis exceeded the burden that RLP actually proposes, because rather than getting into the after-the-fact subjective mindset of Bitumis, how much of the $6.9 million did we subjectively pay to settle these claims as opposed to the others? Instead, the jury was presented with all of the evidence. They were given the HOA's complaint. Here's the universe of liability that GenX was looking at. Here's the universe of claims. And knowing what you know about what GenX did on the project as a construction manager, as the dirt work contractor, and as the manager of the developer, RLP, what portion of that settlement was paid to settle that aspect of the claim? So the jury heard not a subjective viewpoint, but instead looked objectively at what the evidence was that Bitumis and the other parties were looking at when they decided to settle. And I think that Burlington Northern specifically addressed this issue when they said, when the court said, to cast the burden of establishing actual liability and damages on the indemnity would require it to establish its own liability in the action against the indemnitor. And I think that's really what RLP is suggesting, that somehow GenX should have stepped into the shoes of the association and somehow proven actual liability. The trial within a trial would have essentially been the same trial that the HOA would have put on against GenX, except it would have been GenX trying its own case against itself. And the Court of Appeals rejected that, and it said if proof were required of actual liability and damages, the indemnity would be better served to force the injured party to prove his case and then enforce the judgment against the indemnitor. And the Court of Appeals says no, because that would discourage the public policy of settlement. Lastly, with regard to RLP, I would just simply note on the cross appeal that should the court affirm the trial court's judgment, that the court, I believe, it was the motion to amend the judgment to add pre- and post-judgment interest was denied by operation of law under 59J, not through a reasoned analysis by the court. It's a ministerial act that I think should bituminous prevail and the judgment be affirmed, that this court should remand to the trial court simply to calculate the proper amount of pre- and post-judgment interest. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of the time for you.
Your Honors, if a claim is all that's needed to trigger indemnity, when nothing's been proven and only some claims can trigger the right to indemnity, you're going to toss out the precedent established in KECI and D.R. Horton versus D&S Landscaping. In each of those cases, the indemnity agreement was essentially the same. And it's like a run-on sentence that any third grade English teacher would love to edit, but it starts out by saying to protect, defend, indemnify, and hold in the D.R. Horton case. Horton harmless for long claims, defenses, liabilities, damages, whatever. If that's true, if you have to indemnify somebody from a claim, how can a landscaper who, without a doubt, had been claimed to do bad landscaping get out on summary judgment through Judge Graham's opinion? It's because the claim doesn't trigger indemnity. When there's liability in dispute and some architect could be responsible or some other party, the claim doesn't trigger it. And there, summary judgment was upheld because there was no proof of the triggering event, whether the work happened within their scope or whether they were negligent. Same deal here. If the proof doesn't happen that RLP was a manager as opposed to the known defects in construction, that indemnity is a trigger. With respect to the issues of abuse of discretion, the bituminous effectively argues, well, they can call Fitzpatrick as a witness, have him sit at trial counsel table, have a separate argument from Genex, and not do a disclosure. They say that we should have had 2196, the exhibit produced during trial. We briefed that Dennis Polk was a different guy. But aside from the fact that he's a coverage lawyer and not counsel hired by the insurance company, the plain fact of the matter is, what else is out there? There's a reason why the rules of evidence exempt an internal admission from hearsay, because it's such crucial evidence. If they admitted that the rest of the 900,000 was allocated to construction defects, just like the first 600, and they didn't send a letter because that didn't exhaust the policy limits, we should have been entitled to that for a disclosure. And now their argument is they don't have to give it to us because the discovery was frozen and they don't have to do a disclosure. But when they're sitting on documents that they should disclose rightfully that are relevant to the claims and defenses of the case, we should have been entitled to that production. And now we don't know what else is out there from all the other people described in the other related litigation.
Thank you. That exhausts the RLP bituminous issues. Now, if bituminous would proceed as if it were the appellant vis-a-vis Auckland with the remainder of your time, and then you can reserve some for rebuttal if you wish.
Good morning, Your
The second primary set of issues on appeal are the trial court's grant of both a motion for partial summary judgment and ultimately full summary judgment in favor of Oakland and against Bituminous. Bituminous brought a claim similar to the claim that it brought against RLP. This claim arose or dealt not with the liabilities that arose out of Genex's role as manager, but instead liabilities that arose out of the time period that it served as the construction manager and the dirt work contract. And the trial court ruled as a matter of law that the indemnity provision in an assignment agreement was not clear and unequivocal and did not include or contemplate indemnification for Genex's own negligence. And I want to address first the de novo issue of the trial court's interpretation of that indemnity provision. And Bituminous noted in its briefs that several times recently, as recently as March of 2011, the Supreme Court has noted a shift away from this rule of strict construction in indemnity contracts, particularly in a commercial context where you have two sophisticated parties with equal bargaining power. And what the Colorado Supreme Court has said in the Constable case, which is the 2011 case that I referred to, is that an agreement to indemnify need not contain magic language, and particularly in this commercial setting, as long as the language is broad enough to contemplate any and all liabilities, which is what we had in the indemnity agreement between Oakland and Bituminous, that's enough. And that although the court must satisfy itself that that's what was contemplated by the parties, that there need not be any magic language that says we specifically agree to indemnify you for your own negligence. Now, to the extent that the plain language of the agreement is not enough to evidence the intent of the parties, under the Constable case and also the public service case from this court, Supreme Court, 1992, there's also sufficient evidence in the record that should have led either as a question of law, a question of fact, or a mixed question of law and fact to allow the court to determine that the parties specifically did intend that this type of indemnity be included. For example, in the indemnity agreement that's at issue, the parties agreed to relate it back as if Oakland was the original signer of the agreement. So from a temporal standpoint, it's clear that Oakland was not just looking forward as it agreed to indemnify. It was also looking backward for past performance that was specifically done by Genex, as if Oakland was the original signer to the agreement. And moreover, as we cited in our briefs, there was also, at the same time that this indemnity agreement was entered into, there was a separate agreement entered into between Oakland and Genex, where Oakland was essentially trying to buy into the Durango market. And so it bought out numerous contracts from Genex in order to get a foothold into the Durango building market. And in doing that, it assumed all of the liabilities of Genex with respect to those contracts. So when the court's looking first at the plain language and then at the broader evidence that was before the trial court, we believe that the evidence and the language itself shows that there was that intent to indemnify Genex for its own negligence. And therefore, the trial court simply got it wrong as a matter of contract interpretation. But beyond that, even if the Court of Appeals were to affirm the trial court's interpretation of the contract, there were still questions of fact that precluded summary judgment. And specifically, apart from what Genex did or didn't do on this project, and whether Genex's own negligence was the precipitating factor of the HOA's claims, there was also evidence in the record that Oakland contributed to and played a role in the damages that the association was seeking from Genex. For example, Genex was the dirt work contractor. Oakland then became the construction manager and began vertical construction on that faulty soil when it knew or should have known that the soil was bad. And there was evidence in the record that said that had Oakland done its job and recognized the soil and foundation issues, that rather than starting vertical construction, they could have fixed the problem to begin with, it would have eliminated hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in the ultimate cost of repair, because we all know it's a lot cheaper to repair something before you build it than after. Another example is there was evidence that Oakland, while acting as construction manager, left certain areas of the foundation and soil exposed during the winter, which there was evidence in the record to support the notion that that also contributed to the damages and cost of repairs that Genex was being held to account for. When we look at the language of the indemnity agreement here, it was broad. It's very broad language. It talks about any and all other claims. It deals with three issues. It deals with Oakland's performance of the contract or failure to perform. It deals with claims for breach of contract, and it deals with any other claims arising out of the performance of the CM contract. So we believe that the jury should have been allowed, in the same way that it was allowed to apportion the fault with respect to RLP, that the jury, there were questions of fact, and the jury should have been entitled to look at the evidence and say, okay, of the damages that the association was seeking to hold Gen X responsible for, we find that X percentage or X number of dollars was actually arose out of Oakland's performance of the CM contract, and therefore we would be entitled to indemnity under the assignment contract. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Ivan Sarkissian. I represent Oakland Construction. We're here to review two orders that the trial court entered with respect to Oakland's responsibilities to Gen X under an indemnity clause in the contract assignment agreement. The trial court correctly interpreted the contract assignment agreement as not requiring Oakland to indemnify Gen X for its own negligence. The trial court then later on, after the parties had settled the claims with the plaintiff separately, the trial court then was faced with an undisputed fact that it looked at in deciding its second order, which was that Gen X had settled its own liability, but had not settled Oakland's liability. And therefore, based on that undisputed fact, the trial court decided that Gen X was not entitled as a matter of law to recover against Oakland under the indemnity agreement. You heard some from actually the other argument about the fact that Gen X was not a passive participant in this project. Gen X had numerous hats that it wore as the general manager for RLP, as the earthwork contractor under a separate contract outside the construction management agreement, as well as for a period of time serving as the construction manager. This was not a situation where Gen X was hands were clean, so to speak, with respect to potential liability. Gen X had done plenty to bring liability on itself. I do want to address one point that Mr. Wartell made at the beginning of his argument about the de novo review. I think the standard is de novo review, both with respect to the fact that this was a grant of summary judgment and with respect to the fact that this concerns a matter of contract interpretation.
As to the latter point, did anybody argue that the Gen X Oakland indemnity clause was ambiguous and therefore the court should consider extrinsic evidence such as other contracts that Oakland had purchased in the marketplace?
There was not an argument about ambiguity. The only point we made was if the court were to determine that the contract was ambiguous based on the Lafarge case, based on public service, that there would be an absence of a clear, unequivocal statement requiring Oakland to indemnify Gen X for its own negligence, and therefore a finding of ambiguity would be essentially a finding that Gen X would not be entitled to recover for its own negligence under the contract assignment agreement. Again, and I think even the Constable case, which Mr. Wartell referred to, reiterated the long-held principle in Colorado, which requires an agreement purporting to indemnify a party against liability for its own negligence to be enforced as written as long as it contains a clear, unequivocal expression that the parties intended that result. So even with the Constable case, the notion that we could have something less than a clear and unequivocal statement supporting the claim for indemnity of the indemnity's conduct is simply not the law in the state of Colorado. I do want to talk about what the contract assignment agreement says. I have copies for the panel that would be helpful for you to take a look at them. I assume you have the quotes from the brief. The contract assignment agreement is really a document that does two different things. The first is it's an agreement between Oakland, Rivergate Loft Partners, and Gen X. The idea of this agreement was that Oakland would take over the construction project and become bound to RLP as the construction manager. And so we see in the agreement that the parties agreed to assign fully all contractual rights and responsibilities identified in the CM contract. That's the first part of the agreement, that Oakland, RLP, and Gen X agreed that Oakland would step in and take over as the construction manager and do so as if it were the original signer, so that RLP would have the right to proceed against Oakland as if it were the original signer. That language doesn't speak to any obligation as between Oakland and GenX. That language talks only in terms of Oakland's obligation to RLP under the construction management agreement. The next paragraph talks, is actually an interesting paragraph, because the next paragraph goes on to say, in addition to the assumption by Oakland of all of GenX's rights and liabilities, that, what's interesting about that is the paragraph that precedes it defines the scope of the assignment. It uses the term rights and responsibilities. This next paragraph says, in addition to the assumption by Oakland of all of GenX's rights and liabilities and obligations. So there's different language used. I think it confuses the term, but it doesn't confuse the issue, which is that's defining the scope of the assignment as between Oakland and RLP. The parties then set out to separately define an indemnity obligation which would bind Oakland to GenX. And that language says, Oakland will indemnify and hold harmless GenX against any claims for the failure by Oakland to perform, breach of contract, or any other claims related to the performance of the contract. There's no reference to Oakland agreeing to indemnify GenX for its liabilities. There's no broad language that's used as in the Lafarge case or as in the public service case about any or all. This language is carefully crafted to limit Oakland's responsibility to GenX based on Oakland's performance. That's the only reference that there is in that agreement as to the scope of the obligation. It's based on what Oakland does. Had the parties intended GenX to be substituted in, there would be no reason to include reference to Oakland. If there was some idea that GenX would have broad indemnity powers going back to even when it was the construction manager, it would make no sense for the party to include reference to Oakland. But the parties did, and that language is the language that had to be enforced by the trial court, which it did correctly. The second point, then, is the second order, which I actually think is the more interesting issue. The situation we had was the parties had all settled. The plaintiff had sued Oakland. The plaintiff had sued GenX. The plaintiff had sued RLP. GenX at the time, by Tumnus now, had made one cross-claim against Oakland saying that it was entitled to indemnity based on the plaintiff's allegations. That was the only claim that was made in the case. When we approached trial, GenX was the first party to settle, and it entered into a settlement agreement, which you have in the record. Then RLP settled, and then Oakland was the last to settle. It's undisputed that the GenX settlement agreement did nothing to relieve Oakland of any of its obligations to the plaintiff or relieve any of Oakland's liability exposure. Oakland was left to fend for itself. Oakland was left to pay for the sins of Oakland, just as GenX had paid for the sins of GenX. Based on that factual record, we sought summary judgment on the entirety of the GenX claim. We made the argument that GenX settled only for GenX, and the trial court had already decided that Oakland wasn't responsible for paying for the liabilities of GenX. At the time the first motion for summary judgment was filed, Mr. Wartell makes the point, there were factual issues about what Oakland was responsible for or what Oakland wasn't responsible for. That's all true. That's why Oakland only moved for partial summary judgment in the initial order. But once we got to pass the settlements, the factual issues became moot, because the fact of the matter is Oakland was left to pay for its settlement, for its obligations, and GenX paid for its obligations. That's why the idea that Mr. Marvey says that we should have caught the issue sooner or we shouldn't have dumped snow, all of that was taken into account by virtue of the party's settlement. When GenX decides to take advantage of the fact that Oakland is left in the case to pay for the sins of Oakland, GenX cannot then turn around and sue Oakland saying that it should be entitled to receive indemnity for monies it paid. When we briefed this issue, we cited the Bank One case, which is an unreported federal court decision, because it really, I thought, encompassed the concept that we're talking about here. But as we kind of have gone on this path, actually, I think the Burlington court really hit the nail on the head. If you read Burlington, it stands for the proposition that if an indemnity settles a claim, it has a right not to establish its own liability, but establish that the amount of the settlement was reasonable. The Burlington case is fundamentally different than what we have here, because in Burlington, the indemnity settled all of the liability for both the indemnity and the indemnitor. Here, different from Burlington, GenX left Oakland as the indemnitor to settle its own liability. So the analysis of Burlington doesn't really apply. What does apply is the fact that in Burlington, the Court of Appeals had to fashion a new way to deal with what it considered to be the problem created by having to force a jury to examine the thoughts and ideas that went into the settlement. I'm out of time, so that's all I have. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Your Honors, I think that focusing on whether Oakland was released by virtue of Genesis settlement is a red herring. There's three clauses in the indemnity agreement. There's the failure by Oakland to perform, there's breach of contract, and there's any other claims related to the performance of the CM contract. And to borrow from Mr. Sarkissian's phraseology, to the extent that GenX committed a sin while acting or performing under the CM contract, that sin is what GenX and Oakland bargained for Oakland to cover. So I think it's misplaced for us to focus on whether GenX paid to release Oakland. That's more a contribution type analysis. What we're dealing with here is a contractual indemnity provision that specifically dealt with claims related to GenX's performance of the CM contract. And if GenX did something wrong that led to liability, that's what Oakland signed up to pay for. Now, it should be noted that GenX did tender to Oakland this claim. Oakland denied the tender, GenX settled, and reserved its rights to seek an indemnity from Oakland at a later point in time. So that's the context of settlement that's important, I think, for this court, not whether or not GenX paid to release Oakland, but whether GenX paid to settle claims that by contract should have been paid by Oakland. And I think that when the court looks at the prior cases from both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, and most notably the Constable case and the public service case, and you compare the broad language that was examined in those cases with the broad language that's in this indemnity provision, I think it's a match. And I think that the trial court erred in dismissing, especially at summary judgment stage, the indemnity claim. Thank you for your time.
We appreciate the arguments of all counsel, and we appreciate